All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of I Can Steal That, the true crime podcast that's never too heavy. I'm your host, Pete Stegmeier. How's it going, everybody? Episode number 65. Very exciting. Even more exciting, this week, my book officially hit stores, my book Heist. I am super excited. I want to thank everybody for the amazing support. I know we have a lot of new listeners thanks to an Ask Me Anything I did on Reddit. Thank you guys so much for checking out the show. I hope you enjoy it. If you do, please like, subscribe, and leave a review on iTunes. It helps so much. I'm blown away by the response of the book so far. People haven't received it yet. I promise this is not a scam. But so far, it has done so well in the pre-sale that it is officially the number one new release for Amazon. So I'm very excited about that. Thank you guys so much for all of your support. And I promise soon I will stop talking about the book. And also, if you want it signed, I'm more than happy to do that. Just let me know how, and I can get the sign, and we can just contact me at I Can Steal That at gmail.com or on any social media at I Can Steal That, and I'll figure out a way to get a signed copy to you guys or some stickers, whatever you want. All right. So before we get into the episode, let's bring out our guest for this episode. He is one of my best friends. He is my platonic dungeon master. And he's been on the show before. He did our Thor, our Mjolnir heist. He is one of my best friends in the world, Tony Shoshard. How's it going?
Very good. Got the name right this time.
I did. It only took 9 years because that's how men's friendships are sometimes.
Can't rush perfection.
You really can't. All right. So what comes to your mind, Tony, if I say bank robbery, Richard Nixon, surfboards?
The amount of things. Like, I don't even know where to begin with that one.
Like, well, me personally, I go to the classic film Point Break.
Like the old Keanu Reeves?
Yeah, the old Keanu Reeves movie where surfers wore Richard Nixon masks to rob banks.
All right, now that you said that, that's where my head's going.
Okay. And also the remake, not bad. Different movie, but it was fun. I enjoyed it. But today's heist involves all of that stuff, but it is not Point Break.
I was misled then.
I'm actually going to say that it is way cooler, aside from like Patrick Swayze. Like Bodhi is the coolest character of all time. Like, he would make this heist cooler, but everything else is actually way cooler than the movie. So let's talk about the heist that we're getting into today. We are going to be talking about the United California bank robbery, which still, by the way, holds the record as the largest bank robbery in American history.
All right.
Yeah. So this is one I've wanted to do for a really long time. And it's great. Like, there's, and I know a couple people are probably going to mention in the comments and things like that, that there have been some robberies that have yielded more, like perhaps the Brinksmat robbery. Actually, the Brinksmat one was English, but the Dunbar heist technically got more than the low end, but that also wasn't a bank. That was an armored trunk repository. This is like a bank branch robbery that got $30 million.
Okay.
So let me set the scene a little bit. The United California Bank is in Laguna Niguel. And Laguna Niguel is kind of like a small beachy town. If you're like a New York listener or Long Island listener, probably the best thing to compare to would be like Montauk, where it's a beach town, but maybe like a quieter town than Montauk, because at like night there's like really nobody there. It really just kind of sits there, and it's nestled right between the Pacific Coast Highway and the Crown Valley Parkway. But inside this like sleepy little beach town vault sat a huge stash of cash, $30 million in one safety deposit box to be exact. And that money belonged to none other than President Richard Milhouse Nixon. Or his campaign, more specifically.
That is insane. That's just like, hey, I'm just... Is that where he's from? I'm sorry, I don't know the history or origin of Nixon.
I believe that Nixon was a Californian. I'd have to double check that. I'm almost positive he was. But he actually... He had that money sitting in that bank for pretty nefarious reasons. The reason it was there and not somewhere else was because he wanted that money to be hidden.
Okay. I wouldn't look in a little coast town for a large sum of the presidential's wealth.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, if you're looking at you're never going to think that they're just going to put that on, like, the literal edge of the country. You'd think it'd be, like, Kansas or somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere even less likely to look, but...
Exactly, but he played it close to the vest. He wanted it in this little sleepy beach town. And I bet you're wondering, why was this money hidden away like that? And the quick answer to that is that money was super dirty. And what I mean by dirty... is that it was all illegal campaign contributions. And basically, this is the early 70s. This is like 1970, 1971. And in 71, there was a slate of new campaign finance laws that were about to take effect. So basically, Nixon and every other politician, because, you know, the grind and like the hustle to squirrel away cash, that reaches across the aisle. But basically, all the politicians were trying to grab as much dirty money as they could before the law took effect and kind of like squirrel it away.
Yeah, I'm glad that's what finally stopped them.
Yeah, it's been great ever since 1971. Like, I can't...
Leaps and bounds.
It's not fundamentally the same. Corporations aren't people. Anyways, because Nixon was the president and an extremely charismatic individual, his preferred method of this kind of cash grab was campaign contributions, aka bribes.
Yeah, good.
And so basically, during this time, like, people would bribe the president with campaign donations. And again, it's totally different now. So thank goodness this law
changed. That was put into effect, man. It really changed the way that politics were handled.
Yeah, it's everything's better now. But basically, he would do this. And then, I mean, that's just the way politics is. But some of the donations like were pretty infamous. Like he had his like so-called milk money, which was a huge contribution from the dairy industry to kind of stop like some FDA laws from coming into effect.
So I mean, Dannon was corrupt back in the 70s.
Yeah, I like to think Dannon plays it above. Yo Plate though is dirty as shit. If you're not familiar, Yoplait actually launched the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Oh man, everybody needs a side hustle.
Everybody needs a side hustle, but yeah, Yoplait they don't play around. They will like it's like fruit on the bottom, or hold on, yeah, was it fruit on the bottom?
Yeah, you got to mix it up.
Yeah, except like on top of that fruit. Is just like grift and like dark money from Yoplait. fruit on the bottom, coup on top.
So it's like a in-depth marketing scheme of why they came up with the whole double layer mix it yourself type thing.
Exactly.
So it's a cry for help. Somebody on the inside was trying to let their secret out.
100%. That's why they started putting like the little facts and affirmations on. They're like, your government is valid.
Campaign contributions died in the... There was laws on campaign contributions in the 70s.
And so with all that sweet, sweet Yoplait money or dairy industry money in general, another one of the big contributions sitting in that bank account was $3 million from a guy you've probably heard of named Jimmy Hoffa.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. And so for those of you unfamiliar with who Jimmy Hoffa is, he was the head of the Teamsters Union in the 60s and 70s. He was an extremely powerful and influential person, did a lot of activity and business with the mob, obviously, and then famously went missing, potentially killed by Richard Kuklinski, the Iceman, but that's never been conclusively proven. But at the time, he was an extremely effective political entity or power because he controlled the Teamsters, the truck drivers, and truck drivers are still like the backbone of the country now, but at that time, it was even more so. Like, he was a kingmaker. But he was in jail serving a 13-year sentence at the time for various crimes, related to the mob and racketeering and all of that fun stuff, corruption, bribery, all those things.
Yeah. Bare minimum of what people would get into.
Exactly. And
recreational activities.
And Jimmy Hoffa did not like sitting in jail, especially on charges for shit like bribery. And so he had a plan. He was like,
bribe his way out.
I'm going to bribe my way out of jail. And so he calls Richard Nixon and says, hey, I want a pardon. And Nixon's like, I'll give you a pardon, but it's going to cost you $3 million. The endorsement of the Teamsters Union, which typically went Democratic because, pro-union party and things like that. So the Teamsters had to endorse Nixon and pay him $3 million. And then Hoffa was also going to be barred from union activity for 8 years after his release.
The first thing that comes to mind is the fucking balls on this man. That his go-to is all right, what do you want your call to be? Because it's not like there are cell phones and the technology we have now. He's like, I want to talk to the president. And picture the warden or whatever security guard had to facilitate this request and did.
Yeah, this is before Google. You still can't Google the president's phone number. But Jimmy Hoffa had that kind of pull. He could make one of his calls in jail to be, I want to talk to Richard Nixon. And they're like, shit, okay.
That checks out. All right. Let me go dust off the yellow pages or white pages.
I'm going to try that in our next campaign. When I get locked up or something, I'm like, I want to talk to the big bad end guy and just hope I hit 20.
Well, here's your sending stone. Talk into it. It's on the other end.
And so, yeah, but Jimmy Hoffa knows his strikes. He's like, this dude loves bribes anyways. He's like, I'm going to get out for sure. And he does. And so Jimmy Hoffa gets out of prison in 1971, but he's still super pissed about, the fact that he can't be in the union or, he's basically lost his power because he can't participate in union stuff. Thanks. Yeah,
well, that isn't the consequences of my actions. How dare I have to pay for these?
And so he decides that this will not stand. And so he goes to his mob connections and he's like, hey, I need you guys to find out where Nixon keeps his money. And a little while later, his connections come through and they're like, he keeps all of his shady, dark money in the safety deposit box at the United California Bank in Laguna Niguel. And Jimmy Hoffa's like, excellent. I'm going to snatch this dude's soul.
Say less. Check this out.
Say less. And so he reaches out to a pretty prolific bank robber. And I do want to say that the Jimmy Hoffa being the tipster in this is 99%, but none of the people have officially confirmed it. But it's Jimmy Hoffa. I'm just going to throw that out there. He's the one that tipped this off. And so Hoffa, or whoever the tipster was, reaches out to a career thief and bank robber named Emil Dinzio. And Dinzio hailed from Youngstown, Ohio, and he was a consummate professional. He and his crew had robbed, at this point, about 30 banks up and down the East Coast, and they'd taken about $20 million, which is a huge amount in, like, probably nine figures in today's money, because this is 60s and 70s. And he was meticulous. Like, as talented as he was also just very, very professional. Like, left little to nothing in the way of clues, usually cleaned up crime sites and things like that. And they also, and one of the reasons that I like these guys so much is they never went after banks during the daytime. Like, they didn't want to point guns at people. That wasn't their style. And also, like, when people rob banks, like, and, you know, they do the whole, this is a stick up. On average, like, if it's a good day for those guys, they're going to get $10,000. Like, you don't really get much money at all to go in and, like, stick up a bank. Like, they knew that there was much greater money in going after the vault at night, usually on, like, a Friday night. And I appreciate that. I don't really do a lot of violent heists in this because it's just, it's low skill. It's bowling with bumpers. And also like, the money just isn't there. Like, I don't want football team robberies. I want, like, STEM robberies where, like, you had to use math and science for this one. Good job.
Not flip 6-3 hole, like, right up the gut. Like, hold them off for a bit.
I don't even know what that means. But I'm going to say that.
Troopers, man?
Oh, okay. I should know what that means. I thought you were talking football, and my eyes just started glazing over.
Sports ball is not my strong point.
Yeah. I feel like just that conversation lets you know what, like, the signature pages of my yearbook look like. but basically, Jimmy Hoffa tells Danzio, he's like, hey, there's this tiny bank on, like, the literal edge of the continent, and inside is $30 million of Richard Nixon's dark money. And Danzio, like, that's what he's like, say less. And he gets a crew together, and they fly to California and rent a house. And Danzio, he kept his crew pretty tight, which is something you see a lot of professionals do. It was all people that Danzio, like, really truly trusted. And a large portion of his crew was family. So his brother James was a demolition expert, which is just cool. He had his nephew, Harry Barber. A guy named Charles Mulligan was the wheel man. And then he brought in two other guys, Phil Christopher, who served as, like, an alarm expert, and Charles Brokel. And so they rented this house. They kind of just pulled constant surveillance on the comings and goings of the bank. And they also monitored it after hours. So they would, like, watch it over an entire weekend to see, like, what's the traffic light coming back? Like, how, like, do the police check this location? Like, trying to make sure that they could, you know, come up with the best game plan possible. And finally, they decide to strike. On March 24th, 1972, the team climbed, they used a ladder. They climbed up to the roof of the bank. And then they actually took, like, surfboard foam, which is pretty similar to Great Stuff. But it's like an expandable foam that at the time was used to, patch surfboard holes. Like, if you had, like, a piece of coral or another, like, surfer that was, like, stealing your wave or something like that, like, you could fix your surfboard with that expandable styrofoam. And they actually sold it a couple miles down the street from the bank at a surfboard shop. And so as they get to the roof of the building, the alarm guy, they take these cans of spray foam and they start spraying them into the alarms. And what this, and I like this too, because the crew called the alarms loudmouths. So it'd be like, go shut up the loudmouths. And then they would, like, go take the spray foam and spray it inside the alarm. And what this did, once the foam hardened, was it actually stopped that little hammer that rung the bell from being able to move. And also would have dampened any sound that it made if it did work.
Brilliant.
It is. You know, they're like, we got to be quiet. And so after they took that first step to ensure that everything was, you know, going to be silent, they rolled out plan, item number two on the agenda. They drilled 16 holes into the concrete of the roof, and inside each hole, a stick of dynamite.
Good thing they silenced those alarms.
Yeah, they pass the stealth check, and then they're like, let's just blow this shit up. And so they do. They detonate the 16 like sticks of TNT. But luckily, like, it is a very sleepy, like, beach town. Like, nobody's around to hear it. But also now the alarms won't go off. So that's cool. They
thought of everything.
They did. I mean, you only like to blow it up once.
True. Yeah, it's just they just got to hope that 1 second I don't even know how decibel or what loud decibel is going off in the area. Because, I mean, there's a stone quarry right down the street from my house. And about 5-10 miles, when they use dynamite, you hear it. You feel it. Like, it's not a, not like, oh, I hope that they just think it's some tire popping outside or damn kids and their firecrackers.
Yeah, that's when we were in Afghanistan, like, we had like somebody have an ND while doing like a functions check on their weapon, and we were like, hold on, and we just like pushed like like the mechanics like toolbox over to try to like mask the sound, and the company commander comes in, he's like, I feel like I heard what sounded like a gunshot followed 3 to 5 seconds later by a toolbox hitting.
No, sir, that's just how sound travels.
Yeah, it was funny. But then everybody like I Spartacus'd it, and like the guy never figured out who the who had the negligent discharge. But I thought that was really funny. He's like, you guys are idiots.
I mean, you got that like hope and prayer. I remember one time we're in the back of an LMTV, dude with the saw, he fell asleep with it and fired it between his legs.
Oh my god.
You know how like in the middle of the night that muzzle flash lights up that entire cabin, and like it's like one of those, like, he's looking around like, I hope nobody tells on me, and we're like, dude, literally we're the only truck in a convoy, in dead silence, just pop, and like a giant light, they're like, and you're the only one that has like powder burns on your feet.
That's it is honestly a miracle that nobody got hurt with that. That's, could you imagine if that was like an MRAP? Like, it would have just, like, he would have shot every person in the truck with that one round.
Multi-kill.
Oh, man. Good times. But the dynamite works, and it blows the concrete above the vault to smithereens. But because it's a bank, there's still, like, the, you know, the steel rebar as reinforcements throughout the steel.
Yeah.
So they just get to work using like blow torches, and they cut a hole through that rebar, and then they're able to drop that that ladder that they had into the vault. And over the next 3 days, using like specially designed sledgehammers, I hope they were like commemorative sledgehammers. Like, he's like, guys, before we do this job, I just want you to know. At like, he was like asking them to be their groommen, and it was just like, like a sledgehammer that said like Rick on it.
No, like the Broccolizer, just fucking.
Yeah, exactly.
I named him personally for you guys.
It's like, do you know how incriminating this is?
I mean, and just the fact that you had a custom sledgehammer made, like, I don't know what, how custom were they?
Well, from what I understand, it was like a specialized sledgehammer, I guess it would kind of be like a Great Mall or something like that, where like one side is sledgehammer and then the other side is like kind of like a crowbar type thing that you could, or like a pick that you could. Okay. That's my understanding, but that's just based on like some other crimes that I've seen like other people do.
Think of that tool shop. You're sitting there like, hey, can you make this? I've heard of these before. You're not using them for crime? Absolutely not. Oh, it checks out. Here you
I would love if they did like a forged and fired. It was just like Wes. Or I forget the host's name. He's great. Will Williams or Will Weicker or something like that. He's fantastic, Army vet. But if he was just like getting them to build like heist tools, he's like, for this next challenge, we're gonna have the safe crack challenge.
And they just disappear right after the show.
Yeah. Next, we're going to see how check the damage for what this does to a bank teller's kneecap. Remember, it's not about what it does to the kneecap. It's what the kneecap does to your hammer.
Bro, I watched simulated pig kneecaps in because they're closest to humans.
It will steal. God, now I got to make a shirt with that. We got to make a fortune. One. If you're an artist and you would like to make a commission on it will steal, Forged in Fire, I can steal that crossover shirt, please contact me. I will pay you. All right. So getting back to it, using these specialized hammers, over the next 3 days, they smash open and empty just under 500 safety deposit boxes.
Over how many? How long?
Over the next 3 days. So they went in on a Friday night on March 24th. And then over the next 3 days, because nobody came for the weekend, because this is the 70s. So like stuff wasn't open on the weekends. They basically had 3 days to do this. And this is March 24th. So it's possible like that might've been like Easter weekend or something like that as well.
So that Monday might've been off as well.
It might've been, I'm not 100% sure on that. But yeah, and so after, basically after they like load up, they take off. Police discover the robbery that following Monday, and this time they weren't nearly as meticulous as D'Annunzio, or hold on, D'Annunzio. Sorry about that. As D'Annunzio typically was. So when they came in on Monday, bank vault is littered with a bunch of stuff. Like the concrete dust is still there. There's a bunch of cash left on the floor, jewelry, like bonds, like people's urns are just like left on the floor of the vault.
So, I mean, like it's like prior heists when he would do stuff like this, he'd like re-pour the concrete, reset the rebar.
Well, typically, I think he wasn't really blowing holes into the stuff. He was doing more.
Sneaky boy stuff.
Yeah, more kind of sneaky boy, like more like dex check kind of stuff, where you would like pick the locks or something like that. This is, as far as I understand, the first time that he performed a heist with this methodology. But because it was so effective, he did end up trying it again in Ohio after this, and that ends up leading to his undoing, because now the FBI is like, okay, well, this is clearly the same people.
Yeah.
The other thing, unfortunately, that led to their undoing was the house that they rented before they took off. They didn't run their dishwasher. And so the FBI, because the house ended up being rented in one of their names, they use their real names, which is not smart. They also use their real names to book the tickets to fly there, which, again, not crazy smart.
Yeah, that'd be there.
But I think because he had never been caught at this time, like he probably just got cocky with it. He's like, there's no way they're going to like link us to all this stuff. But because he did pretty much the exact same robbery in Ohio, I believe actually in Youngstown, that ended up getting the attention of the FBI. And Nixon was furious about this because at this, like, they stole at least, the official estimate puts it, like official finger quotes, as $13 million. Pretty much every source that I've seen puts it at around $30 million of Nixon's money. And then there's also no telling how much they stole from all of the other safe deposit boxes.
Made more than one score than he did in his entire career up to that point.
Yeah, pretty much. It was a huge win for them. And also, like, safe deposit boxes are notoriously unreported when people break into them, because that's where people keep their secrets. And that was actually what D'Annunzio was hoping with this case. Part of the reason that he felt comfortable doing it, and like he didn't have to be as meticulous, is basically he said, well, this is all of Nixon's like dirt money. Like he can't, like if he comes after us for this, he's admitting guilt and corruption, and he would never do that.
solid point.
Yeah, except if rule number one is never stage a land war in Asia, surely rule number three would be never assume an outcome that relies on Dick Nixon taking the moral high ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, for that to work, you have to be like, you know, the person has to understand shame. And Nixon did not. And you could tell, by the way, that he was, like, extremely pissed about this, because usually a bank robbery, especially one of, like, this size and scale, it's going to obviously get the attention of the FBI, but they're going to send, you know, 4 or 5 agents for a standard bank robbery. Do you want to guess how many FBI agents were sent to this bank?
I'm going to guess 35.
Oh, you'd be actually only 25% of the way there.
Oh, 140?
Yeah, between 120 and 150.
Yeah, I
mean, that is a full infantry company of FBI agents.
That many people can't even fit in the bank.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. It's probably spread out throughout an area, but...
Yeah, but it's still... It's so bad.
Part of me, from being like from Ohio, I hope there's like a tip off to these people, because the Californians are like, these guys keep saying pop. That ain't right. There's some weirdos there. And just that Ohio is one of the few states that use the word pop.
I love stuff like that. Like, my favorite story of that is during like the Bay of Pigs invasion. They figured out that the Russians were helping the Cubans, because they had like satellite footage, they saw them building like soccer fields instead of baseball diamonds. And the CIA was basically able to be like, okay, well, like, Cubans don't play soccer. Cubans play baseball. There's Russians on this island. And that was kind of how the Bay of Pigs kicked off, or one of the factors that led them to realizing that the Russians were in Cuba.
That's actually pretty awesome. I didn't know
that. It's awesome. I love stuff like that. But basically, like, the guys start to scatter. Barber ends up like living in upstate Pennsylvania for the next 8 years. Like, he's on the run. They do pretty quickly arrest. Let me grab his name. I'm just blanking on the Brokel. They end up arresting him pretty quick, and he does kind of flip on pretty much everybody else. And Brokel wasn't as tight knit with the group. Like, he didn't really have any skills either. He was just there to be the muscle. And even then, like, they didn't really need muscle, because there wasn't anybody there. So he just kind of helped crack open the boxes. But, according to legend, at least, Jimmy Hoffa, like, because he tipped off the crew, that was his guy that he was putting inside the crew.
That the plant.
Yeah, you always, like, anytime somebody, like, recommends a crew to somebody, they're always going to have, like, the plant, or, like, the, you know, like, the person that, like, goes to be the eyes and ears and help them. And, like, sometimes it's, like, somebody important that they need, like, in the Hatton Garden heist with Basil. He was very important and most likely sent by the organized crime unit. But, yeah, there's always going to be that guy. And... Brokel was that guy for this crew, and he gets arrested like pretty quickly and ends up flipping. He got immunity from the prosecution in exchange for that too.
So, I mean, he got a good deal out of it. Like,
yeah,
he for snitching, but
yeah, exactly. And as for the rest of the crew, some of them stayed on the run for a while, like I said with Barber. He ended up going into hiding in rural northern Pennsylvania. He kind of assumed that nobody would find him there because he hated the cold, but he ended up getting nabbed actually when he went to renew his driver's license. And Dinzio, he was also arrested, but I am having a really hard time. Like, I've gone through a bunch of I've gone through a bunch of different like things, and I'm struggling to find an arrest date, but I know that he was sentenced to 48 months in prison for the Ohio robbery, and that was what tied him to this. Eventually, all six of the members of the crew did get sentenced, but again, I don't know if it's because of the nature of the testimony, and also it's worth pointing out, Brokaw ended up going into witness protection as well. So he got immunity and witness protection, but I couldn't find complete notifications for each of their sentences, but they did all get arrested and convicted, and almost all of the money did end up getting recovered, and kind of impossible to know the impact it had on Nixon's career, because at that point there were so many scandals going on to know if this one would have sunk him by itself, but he did ultimately resign in disgrace.
Yeah, sad. The things you hear about him, this is not one of them.
Yeah, it's like I had heard a little bit about the milk money, and the milk money was only, I think, like $500,000 or $600,000. So it wasn't even like a huge, I mean, it is huge and substantial, but not crazy. It's not like $30 million just from the dairy industry.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the story of this. There is actually a movie out about it called Finding Steve McQueen, but I haven't seen that yet. I might actually check it out tonight, because it sounds fascinating. I just love the story because it's just, it would, I know they made a movie about it, but it would make like such a good, like if you could get like an ensemble cast for it and let like Guy Ritchie, let's see. I want Guy Ritchie to direct it, but I have to remember what his last movie was, because he does like good movie, bad movie, good movie, bad movie right now. So I might need one more to come out.
Just got to let it fall into place when it needs to be.
Exactly. Like I can't like have him do it like after Snatch, because the next movie is going to be garbage. I hope that's accurate. I don't remember. That's fine. But yeah, that was the story of the United California Bank heist. I love that story so much. I have to ask you, Tony, how would you design a D&D campaign around a heist?
So one, I think it would start with a vault. So actually where whatever you were going for was kept, and then just fill it in from there. So the labyrinth that it would be to get to said vault, and the very specific requirements to open said vault.
I like it. I had a couple people during the Ask Me Anything ask those questions, and it's fun to think about the stuff to take into consideration. I also like thinking about you get through the vault, you steal the item. What happens? Because if you're just if it's a jewel worth $1 million, how are you going to fence it? Are you going to get arrested when you try to do it? Do you just have a giant rock with you now?
I think that would definitely be the middle point. So step one, finding out about it, coming up with a plan, doing that. Step two, actually getting in and getting it out. Then step three, what are you going to do? Because especially D&D, somebody's going to know that happened. If it's not the actual person that you stole it from, it's some rival person that's going to want it more than you. And you just did the groundwork for him.
Exactly. Oh, that's fun to think about, though, right?
Now I am thinking there might be some writing in the near future. Excellent. I mean, the one you guys are currently playing, you're going into a bank soon.
Well, there we go. I already have a plan for that. I am going to start a rival bank with competitive interest rates.
Cash back on purchases.
Double cash back on staples like groceries and ingots.
Raw materials for forging.
But yeah, that was the episode. This has been super fun. Thank you again for doing this, Tony.
Oh, thank you for inviting me again.
Of course. And thank you to everybody that's listening, that's supporting me by purchasing the book or you know, telling people about the podcast. It's been amazing to see so many new listeners, and I'm really having a great time with this. I hope you guys are too. And if there's anything you want me to cover, any kind of like segments you want, you just want a shout out, I'll do shout outs. Just go ahead, drop me a line at I Can Steal That. And if you review my book on Amazon or include a screenshot of an iTunes review, let me know and I will mail you one of our I Can Steal That stickers. But don't review the book if you hate it. That would be
counterproductive.
No, you know what? Go for it. I can deal with the honesty. I have fun doing this. Yeah, that's been this week's episode. We'll be back very soon with a new episode of I Can Steal That. Thanks again for listening, guys.